This is XTP Media.
Hi, I'm Anthony Lindberg, Creative Director at Basic 6, and this episode is brought to you with the support of Basic 6. Basic 6 t-shirts are organic and ethically made. If you want a great t-shirt that shows that you know enough about aviation and aerospace by the designs they display, then get over to basic6.co.uk. Shipped anywhere in the world, you will get a 10% discount by using the promo code EXTENDED. You can only get this discount through this promotion, so wear the Aerospace to be seen in t-shirt. Go to basic6.co.uk. Enjoy the show.
Hi, this is Mark from the Maiden Flight Podcast. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the flight, because this is Extended.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 32 of Extended, Europe's premier aerospace radio station. And joining me in the studio today are my good friends and presenters. Firstly, editor at Global Aviation Resource, Gareth Stringer. Gareth, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
I'm very good, thanks. And, of course, the editor-in-chief of Aerospace Magazine, Tim Robinson. Tim, how are you?
Very good indeed, yeah. Hello, everybody.
And we have a special guest host today, editor of PC Pilot, Derek Davis. Derek, welcome to Extended.
Hi, Peter. How are you? Thanks for inviting me.
It's a delight to have you. We've got lots and lots to get through. I know we have a lot of listener engagement for you to talk to us about, but a little more of that later. We've got a fully packed episode, and aside from speaking to Derek about flight simulation, we've got an interview with Gabriella Somerville, who's the Managing Director at ConnectJets, to talk about the Avanti Evo. And we've got a call into the show from Darren Olivier, Senior Correspondent for African Defence Review. And that comes live from the African Aerospace and Defence Expo. We also have a full suite of our regular segments, and lots of you have sent us Get Involved feedback for us to get through as well. Tim's got a new X10 Top 10. Amy has a regional pods challenge for us this time round. And our favourite segment, Promoting Aerospace, along with a reminder of our Aerospace X Awards, and that will round out the programme. So, lots to get through, but as always, let's get cracking by what's caught our eye in the aerospace news. Okay, Gareth, the first story we have on the list today is the Sea Vixen. It's leaving Bournemouth.
Yeah, it's left, and she's now at Royal Naval Air Station Yeovilton. So she's come home in many ways, and this has all come about because the owner of the aircraft, Julian Jones, DS Aviation was the company, has essentially gifted it to the Fly Navy Heritage Trust for a nominal sum of £1, and within the purchase, obviously they've got the aircraft, they've also got sort of 80 tons of spare parts, tools and equipment, and also the support of Paul Kingsbury, PK, who many people will know has been Foxy, Foxy Lady as she's known, been Foxy's engineer for a long time, and that secures his support for another 12 months as well. So the plan is that we will get to see her far more often than we have done in the past few years, but she is going to need funds. There will be specific Sea Vixen funding set up I believe, in the not too distant future. But essentially, you know, fantastic to see. You know, she's the world's last remaining airworthy sea vixen. You know, she's back at a proper flying station, going to be in great care, and hopefully she will have a long life ahead of her.
Gareth, will she be part of then the Heritage Trust, the Royal Navy Heritage Trust's portfolio?
She will. So the Fly Navy Heritage Trust is kind of the, sort of the charitable arm of the Royal Navy Historic Flight, and yeah, it's all quite complicated in terms of sort of aircraft ownership and all those, and you know, and how you can raise funds and whether things are, you know, military or civilian. It's, you know, it's a ridiculous sort of minefield of red tape as much as anything these days. But yes, she will essentially be part of the historic flight. And they, I should add, this is quite, I know, relevant to you, Peter, they've been very, very keen to say that she's not joining the flight to the detriment of the existing aircraft, you know, two Swordfish, yeah, two Sea Furies, one of which obviously was unfortunately damaged when Chris Gotka performed a forced landing at Caldros a few weeks back, and also the Seahawk that we haven't seen for a while, but again a unique classic jet that you know, the Seahawk has not got a long life ahead of it, but is certainly an aircraft that we could see. So that, you know, there's a fleet of aircraft there for them to raise funds for, and Sea Vixen is a big expensive sort of, you know, thirsty bird, but she's incredibly impressive. She's a wonderful piece of British engineering, and let's hope she and all of their aircraft, because they have been very unlucky in the past sort of 4 or 5 years with serviceability and such like, let's hope they all thrive.
Here. I'm actually down there later this week, so I'm hoping to get the chance to see her in her new surroundings. So
brilliant. Fantastic.
Get a couple of pickies to put up on our Facebook and Twitter pages. Staying with Heritage Aviation, we've had a fantastic summer. Many people have talked about what an amazing sight it's been to see. But the two Lancasters are about to separate, and the Canadian aircraft is due to return back.
That's right. We're recording on Monday evening, and all being well, tomorrow, Vera heads back home to the Canadian Warplane Heritage Museum, and you're absolutely right. I can't kind of sum it up any better than that. It's been an incredible summer, and what a huge privilege and honour to see those two aircraft flying together, and to, you know, very humbling as well to think of what it represents. I was very lucky at Dawlish Air Show where we had the two aircraft booked a few weeks ago, which some of you will know is a show that I'm quite heavily involved in, that to, you know, to stand there, you know, I'm not afraid to admit it, with a tear in my eye, because, you know, we had Lancaster pilots there that I met, you know, 90, 94 year old gentlemen, and it just brought it home as to what it actually represented. And in terms of a sort of adventure in this day and age, with them flying that transatlantic trip, you know, and they do the whole thing in reverse now to go home to Canada, I think that everybody, and this has gone far beyond the enthusiast community, this is something that I think has captured the imagination of the great British public at the air show, which is as an event, is something that the Brits absolutely love. And I think each and every one of us should just say thank you so much to every single person, whatever their involvement, but whoever it was that made that happen, whatever their role, because it's an incredible honour, an incredible privilege, probably something that we're not going to see again in our lifetime. But thank you very, very much, and they'll probably be pretty much back by the time this is out, but safe journey back, guys, and it's been lovely having you over here.
Definitely. yeah fantastic sight.
I was at the Duxford show, seeing them there, and you know, honestly, the atmosphere was absolutely electric in the cloud, in the crowd, just really sort of people just kind of sort of awestruck, you know, standing ovation when they turned up, and sort of standing ovation when they left as well.
Yeah. I think that's been everywhere, hasn't it? It's been quite amazing.
Sorry, chaps, I had a funny experience last week when I heard, because I live in the West Country, and I heard this drone going over my house, and I thought, I recognise that sound. I haven't heard it since I was watching the Dam Busters last weekend. So I happened to be in my bathroom on the first floor, and I stuck my head out of the window. Coming from left to right was a Lancaster, quite low. And I thought, wow. But that's all I could think of. But then I realized that the sound was continuing, and behind it was the other Lancaster, just quite almost a few feet away from it. And I just couldn't believe it. And then it was being escorted by a Hurricane. And I just thought, my own free air show with the Lancasters that I've been watching on the internet over my own house.
Derek, we don't live far apart, I don't think, and I think I saw them on the very same day.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, because I live in Chippenham. Where do you live?
I live down in Dorset.
Oh, right.
Okay. And I think they were transiting, weren't they?
I had no idea why they were there. I, to be honest, I didn't care. It was kind of like one of you guys said, it was a complete honour and pleasure just to see them. You know?
Yeah.
I was just dumbstruck, really.
Let's move on to something slightly more modern, but I'm particularly intrigued by, and that is the reports earlier this month on the 2nd of September of witnesses reporting streaks across the sky, fireballs and so forth in America. Turns out a Russian satellite was returning to Earth back into the atmosphere, and some parts of it came down across America. Apparently, that's all been denied, and the satellite did, in fact, return its cargo to Russia. However, the point that I suppose baffled me was I didn't realise that this satellite was a film-carrying satellite returning a film back to Russia, a spy satellite. Tim, I didn't realise that in the world of iPhones and whatnots, we still had satellites up there returning film canisters back to Earth.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, in terms of electronics miniaturization of components and high definition CCD cameras and things like that. The US is still, the US was ahead in the Cold War, and you can probably sort of guess from there that it's still ahead now in terms of having the US satellites with real time ability to downlink, digital images, whereas the Russians go for capsules and on film. So quite interesting. Maybe there's some other reasons for that. Maybe they feel that perhaps there's benefits perhaps in that it can't be jammed, or that you get a better quality picture. It's better. Better resolution. Eventually, when you get the camera down, I don't know. Kind of interesting. Still using film capsules.
Well, moving on to the next stage in space travel, NASA's revealed its selection of crewed craft in the commercial crew program to go and transport their astronauts initially to the ISS, but beyond possibly as well. And Boeing's CST-100 and SpaceX's Crew Dragon, the Dragon 2, have been selected. I suppose the question I wanted to ask is Sierra Nevada's Dream Chaser, which is more like a space plane. And of course, we had Bristol Space Planes on the show a few months ago. Is this going to mean the end of the space plane? Are space planes only going to be limited to tourist trips now, do you think, Tim? Or is there any other message to read from that?
Well, I think the this is the return to low Earth orbit for manned missions. Getting astronauts to the International Space Station back. So NASA and the US government, they were looking for to try and kind of, they had a number of companies competing, so they had to kind of narrow it down somewhere. SpaceX obviously has been going great guns.
Yeah.
That's already there for the cargo. Boeing, they probably went for, because Boeing is an established player. Big giant aerospace company, sort of decades of experience. Dream Chaser, a little bit of a new kid on the block, and it's kind of unfortunate. It looks a bit, actually, you look at the Dream Chaser, it's very similar to a European mini space shuttle idea. I think it was Hermes. That was kind of going to launch on the top of an Ariane. So what happens next? I'm not entirely certain. You know, there are obviously people sort of talking about space tourism. So perhaps that's one route they could go down. It all depends. You know, having kind of been removed from this next step in the competition is whether they've got enough funding to do something privately, or whether that's it. Because as we found out, with the Russian rockets, the geopolitical sort of tensions, and the fact that America's been relying on Russian rockets to put spy satellites in place, Russian rocket engines, people are now sort of concerned about, well, don't put all your eggs into one basket. The question now is whether SpaceX and Boeing is enough. You know, probably the government and NASA think that should be enough of a cushion.
I think the contract allows in 4 or 5 years' time for them to look elsewhere if this hasn't quite worked out for them. So I think they've left themselves a door open. I also noticed that. The United Nations and ICAO were hinting about getting involved in regulating space travel because of the plethora of space planes being developed now. So nothing sacred, as they say, not even in space. Okay, let's move on then to our final story. Just before we go, it was great to see Stephanie Sheerholtz, by the way, hosting the announcement. Stephanie, a previous guest on Extended back in 2012. So well done to Stephanie there. Our final story comes from Dovetail Games, and that is the story about the deal they've done with Microsoft to take their flight simulator product. Tim, one for Derek, maybe.
I think so. Over to the editor of PC Pilot. What's this all about?
Well, essentially, Dovetail, as they've said in their press release, have got the complete rights to the Microsoft Flight Simulator franchise. FSX came out, I think, back in 2006, so nothing's happened apart from the third party World of Flight Simulation. So as far as the franchise, which has been going over for over 25 years, Microsoft had kind of dropped the ball on that one. So nobody knew what was going on and what was the future held for the franchise. They bought out Microsoft Flight, which generally was considered, there's two ways of looking at it. You can either consider it a failure or a brave attempt, really. It left a lot of those who had invested years and money in FSX, FS 2004, with a kind of bad taste in their mouth. So when Flight came out, it was basically inadequate in terms of scope and in terms of what you could do with it, really. So when the news came out earlier this around summertime, that Dovetail had basically taken up the baton and had got hold of the franchise, there are mixed feelings, really, because I think the biggest one was nobody had ever heard, not many people have heard of the word Dovetail Games. If you're a train simulator fan, you would know who Dovetail Games were, but not when it came to flight simulation. So there are a lot of questions being asked, especially with us, PC Pilots. So that's why we did that special interview with them, which is in the current issue of PC Pilot, on finding out, one, really, who they were, two, their ethos, because I felt that really their attitudes to the genre would dictate anything they did with that kind of license to produce whatever they're going to produce or sell. At the moment, they're going to be releasing FSX on Steam, which is going to happen sometime this month. And then what they do with future products or new products, that's open to conjecture. But I felt it personally. Initially, I was sceptical, but as I found out more about the company, I felt that it was really a marriage made in heaven. Because if you look at the well-known product, Train Simulator, and Train Simulator 2015 came out, I think last week. It's a bit like the old cliche: trains, planes, and automobiles. The mindset is the same whether you're, you know, driving a train or flying an aircraft or driving a car. That there are certain commonalities between all three, you know, subjects really. And I felt that really, if they were going to choose any company in the world that wasn't related to flight simulation, immediately, Dovetail was really a kind of a genius decision. And I'm not sure whether Dovetail approached Microsoft or it was the other way around or whether it was mutual. But I'm quite optimistic about the whole venture, really.
Derek, where does this leave Microsoft then in terms of future development of products like this, do you think?
If you look at the existing evidence and facts and press releases, essentially, they, you know, if you think really, Microsoft haven't been in the flight sim game since 2006. So that's 8 years, and that's a long time when you consider that every iteration of Flight Simulator, whether it was 2004, 95, 98, whatever, there was on average a 2 to 3 year gap. So now we have this 8 year gap. So essentially, I don't think, you know, I could be proven wrong, but I don't think Microsoft are really that interested. And I think the words they use, not the exact words, I'll paraphrase them, was that it wasn't part of their future business plan. It didn't fit into their portfolio.
So, Derek, when we've got, assuming that kind of Dovetail Games, you know, work on the, you know, new FSX, well, you know, happy FX something else, FX11,
yeah,
FX12, you know, presuming, you know, there's an 8 year gap between the last one, is going to be like a big jump in you know, the levels of detail and the graphics? So, do you think this is going to be like a big kind of, I hate to use the word sort of killer app, but, you know, people are going to be like, sort of have their breath taken away as, wow, you know, this is what like, flight sims can be?
I think all we can do is speculate, because nobody knows. If I'm honest, nobody knows the answer to that. If you think, I suppose, thinking logically, it would have to be quite significant, given what you've premised there. It would have to be visually a significant change from FSX. But if you look at the third-party products that have been released since 2006, and you compare them to the default aircraft they get with FSX, and you compare them to, say, the PMDGs of this world or the A2A simulations of this world, it's a quantum leap already, visually. And what developers tend to do now, they use the flight simulator engine as an environment in which they plug in their products. So by doing that, they're not limited by the host software, which is FSX. So up to, for example, FSX is a 32-bit application, not a 64-bit application. And then when you compare the polygon counts between the default aircraft and, say, the add-on aircraft, again, but what I mean by polygon count, actually how detailed and how realistic they look, then you can see there's a difference. So anything that Dovetail bring out has to, if at the very least, equal what we currently have in the third party market.
Okay, thanks very much for that, everyone. Let's crack on then. After the break, I get to speak to Gabriella Somerville, who is the Managing Director of ConnectJets, and we get to talk about ConnectJets being the official UK dealer for Piaggio, and of course that beautiful, and some would say iconic, Avanti Evo.
Yes, sir, we have a ill passenger on board and possibly will have to divert to Narita. Request Mach 7-8 while we further coordinate with medical staff.
American 182.
Thank you, sir.
Tokyo Control, American 182.
American 182, go ahead.
Yes, sir. We have a possible diversion to Narita. We're not declaring emergency yet, but would like Narita weather.
American 182, confirm you're now ready for descent?
Negative, sir. Not ready for descent, just need the weather.
Do you need fuel dumping?
Negative fuel dumping. We are not declaring an emergency yet. We are just planning in case we have to divert into Narita. We need to know the weather.
Okay, stand by. American
182,
Tokyo.
Tokyo, American 182, go ahead.
We got a report on Narita, but we have a construction on the Narita. Both runways. So, if you're gonna divert or within ground system, if you need divert, you need to take the Narita out of the ACC.
Okay, understand. The airport is closed. If we need to divert, we need to go to Haneda.
Yes, Narita Airport is closed due to construction on runway.
Roger, thank you.
American 182, so do you need a net report at Haneda?
Yes, sir, request a net report for Haneda.
Yes, stand by.
We have not decided whether or not we have to divert. We'll have a decision for you in 2 minutes.
American 182?
Yes, sir, go ahead.
Okay, I just confirm again. Do you need to divert to Haneda?
Not yet. We are conferring with the doctor in the back of the aircraft. We are not sure if we have to divert yet. We will call you in 2 minutes.
Present.
Tokyo, American 182.
Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Until we make the decision, we'd like to continue present heading a 130.
American 182, the flight heading 130.
Thank you. 2990 QNH down descend to 10,000 American 182. Leaving 15,000.
American 182, information.
Go ahead, sir.
After landing, post number is 131, and the ambulance is waiting at your spot.
Okay, thank you. Spot or gate 131 and ambulance is waiting.
American 182 in town, left heading 300.
Left 300, American 182.
American 182, contact Tokyo approach 119 decimal 1, good back.
119 decimal 1, good day. Control American 182 is descending to 10,000.
American 182, contact Tokyo approach 119.1.
That's right.
From across the globe, from the center of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society has a range of specialist groups which focus on a specific domain or discipline. They form a vital interface between the society and the world at large, and serve both the interests of enthusiasts and professionals through debate, conferences, lectures, and other activities. Learn how you can get involved. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Okay, I'm in a delightful part of London, and I'm with Gabriella Somerville from ConnectJets. Gabriella, welcome to Extended.
Thank you. It's lovely to meet you, and thank you for the opportunity this morning to talk to Extended.
We want to find a little bit more about the aircraft that we saw at Farnborough, iconic aircraft. But can you tell us a little bit about ConnectJets? Who are ConnectJets, and what do you do?
ConnectJets was started in 2009. It was started with just two of us in my back garden. It was sort of born after a time of being in aviation since I was 19. So I started it in my early 40s. And really, you know, I'd always envisioned having a company of my own. And it seemed perfect timing. And there was a gap in the market, which was allowing us at that time, it wasn't an economic downturn.
Yeah.
but there was a gap that allowed us to offer some solutions, some products and programs that were going to look more and benefit more the client that was in the downturn. So we took the position. I think there's never a right time to start a company. But in a sense, we saw strength, even in the market being in a depressed state, to start a brokerage and offer different solutions, different opportunities for clients that were potentially having some issues and troubles with their current, whether it be their aircraft or their programs.
Right, okay. And when we talk about aircraft, we're predominantly talking about what most would class as the business sector.
Correct.
And the corporate sector. What sort of clients are attracted to a company like ConnectJets in this sector?
Well, I think ConnectJets, we've always been quite a niche business aviation provider. We've been slightly off on radar and off radar at times. But I think what we do is we offer a very bespoke, tailored service. We have a number of clients from government to private entrepreneurs to companies, corporations. And so people look to us, obviously, for their charter solutions. And also, because my experience in the industry, having been in it now some 20-odd years, I think that we've drawn a lot of clientele based on the experience that we've had within our team. That is able to advise on charter, able to advise on selling an aircraft, buying an aircraft. We've also been involved in leasing business aviation. That was particularly in the downturn. So we have quite a broad spectrum of services, and I think the experience of what we offered at that time in the market, which has been pretty much a young and embryonic market, sort of gave our clients a degree of confidence. So I think in our position, in that sense, then we had a certain market share. I think ConnectJets have never desired to be one of the bigger, let's say, charter brokers. As I said, we are quite niche, we're quite small. As Richard Branson said, small is beautiful. And to an extent, that's what we have. And so we give a very personalised sort of private service to our clients. And in that, I think we've achieved what we wanted to do, and we'll continue to do that.
Okay. Now, we met at Farnborough. It was a very busy day for you. You had some clients looking at some aircraft. How was Farnborough for you?
Farnborough this year was it was a very busy show in many ways. In fact, it was a very, I think, you know, very energetic show. There's a lot more sort of for us as a company to be engaged with, particularly as we were talking earlier, the Piaggio Avanti. The aircraft was being sort of launched through the experimental model. So it was a very busy time for us. It was obviously great weather. It was a very busy stand. We had a lot of the team over from Italy that I was meeting, some of them for the first time. So it was a very busy, but a very very entertaining and very productive week at Farnborough, for sure.
Right, okay. Yeah. Now, I wanted to ask you about that aircraft. Some would describe it as iconic. Some would describe it as beautiful. Others would describe it as unusual. But I think what it is unique to its field. Can you tell us a little bit about what the aircraft brings to the industry that makes it so special?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, the Piaggio. I think it was one of the aircraft, you know, I like to pick a challenge. And I think this aircraft, if we're honest here, it's a twin turboprop, which is sometimes not always, you know, jets have been at the forefront of the market, although I do believe that the turboprops have got a revival at the moment because they make plain sense on paper. But the Piaggio Avanti Evo is a fantastic aircraft. Yes, you're right, she is a niche-looking aircraft. She's a bit like Marmite, you either lover or hater. I did try and explain that to the Italians and actually gave them some Marmite as a demonstration to that. She, you know, and she is that. And I think it is, you know, there is a niche market for the Piaggio. Yeah. But the interesting thing with this aircraft is she's a real beaut in terms that you may have some hesitancy in a client going onto twin turboprop or going onto an aircraft that looks slightly strange, because we are all creatures of habit and we like to know what something looks like. But the Avanti for us, even on the charter market, has had a huge amount or had a huge following. Once we get the passenger on the aircraft, they don't go back. You know, and we had an interesting story. We had a client that was looking at a Learjet 60. We took him to Farnborough, to eBase. he was laughing at the Avanti and the way that it looked, but he said, seeing as you're sending it, Gabriella, I'll come and sit on it. He then came and sat on the aircraft, and in terms of comfort, you know, you're looking at a much wider cabin, a much taller cabin. The chairs are Italian sort of style. They're comfortable. So the ambience and the whole cabin experience is a lot different in terms of category for the aircraft. And then obviously going alongside that and then looking at the different aircraft within that category at the time, my client's preference, you know, came back to the Evo. So they demonstrates in somebody turning around from a jet engine to a twin turboprop. But fundamentally, that was about its inner sort of comfort levels.
Well, that's where he's going to be, or he or she is going to be sat, isn't it? I think if you blindfolded somebody and put them inside this cabin, it's larger than most of its competitors. I think it would be a no-brainer decision in terms of the quality inside the, the cabin to go ahead. And then it's an argument about efficiency and so forth. And again, the Evo really wins hands down there.
It does, and I think that's the second part that I was going to go on to, that when obviously most of our clients are going to look at you know, their Excel spreadsheet and look at the numbers, now this aircraft makes sense, you know, in terms of numbers. You know, it is sipping fuel, it isn't guzzling fuel, it is one of the greenest aircraft out there, in terms of, you know, it can fly as high as a jet and as fast as a jet, but actually, you know, you're talking about 50% burn on fuel. Now, these things matter now more than they did, you know, prior to 2009. Our clients are getting a lot smarter now, so they are looking in terms of, let's look at an aircraft that makes sense on paper as well as makes sense for us in terms of, you know, the overall experience. The other thing is it goes into certain airfields, you know, quite well in terms of its capability and its short field capability. So you're looking at Siena, Lugano. One of my clients who's hopefully going to purchase the new Evo is flying to Gibraltar. So you're looking at these particular airfields that have had, you know, that are slightly more difficult in testing, but the Piaggio goes in with ease. So in one sense, it is almost like I say, the Avanti is the best kept secret in, in one way, and that now she's being exposed to a UK market. Hopefully we'll be able to really, you know, exhibit what this aircraft can do and see that it makes sense on paper, and it will actually, you know, have a stronger presence here in the UK than it has.
And it's got quite an amazing range, hasn't it? It's almost 2,000 miles, which makes it almost coast-to-coast US. But for UK and European buyers, that's city-to-city pretty much full stop.
Absolutely. It's got very good range. It's got about 1,500 nautical miles, but the Evo with the extended tank go about 1,750 nautical miles. So, you know, we're looking at an aircraft here that you're absolutely right can do the distance and also have the cabin comfort with it. And I think that really adds up for a lot of clients in terms of if they want to, it will go to, let's say, Russia and back. So that's the sort of range that we're looking at, which is quite attractive because it can cover most of Europe, but it can also fly with ease to Russia. And then further afield, it can do it maybe one fuel stop, depending on sort of load and passengers.
And in terms of where the aircraft is in design and manufacturer, where is it in the process at the moment?
What I know is that they are on schedule, and there is some hope that we may have it prior to its full sort of unveiling at NBAA. So it will be going via flying at some point over the UK. And if all goes well, then we're hoping to do a roadshow here on the 17th of October, where we will then exhibit the Evo to a London audience at London City. But in terms of where it is at the moment, yes, as far as I know, it's on time. The first client, and obviously you know that there's been a lot of forward sales on this aircraft. So it's a very ambitious, but also a very good time for Piaggio.
And as their dealer in the UK, their official dealer, how easy is it as an aircraft to sell? I mean, she's pretty to me, but it says all the right things on the stats page as well. Is it an easy proposition to sell?
No, I don't think it is easy. And I think when you've got an aircraft that actually isn't in the market, in the UK market, you're breaking up the fallow ground. And when you're breaking up fallow ground, you come against a little bit of resistance. So the resistance really is that it's just an unknown to a lot of people. I mean, the Piaggio has done very well in France, in Italy, in Germany. But in the UK, they haven't really broken through into this market. The King Airs obviously had a strong, you know, dominating sort of presence here. So for us, it's really about education. So it's about now educating our clients to a different aircraft type that's manufactured in Italy, giving them a little bit more of the history of Piaggio, so really giving them that confidence in the aircraft. I mean, we've worked as a dealer to try and create a sort of cornerstone of infrastructure where our clients feel comfortable. So we've looked at maintenance, we've looked at all the areas where the client needs to feel satisfied with actually owning an aircraft in the UK, making sure that it can be maintained here and looked after. So those elements that when we were given the dealership, which we looked at and said, look, for us to go out and sell this aircraft, we've got to have a structure here which gives our client confidence, and that wasn't here. So we're developing certain infrastructures to create that confidence, and I believe that once we have one aircraft here, the more that it's seen, then the more that the market will follow. And you know, as I say again, in terms of performance and what it can do, I think it, you know, people are going to be attracted to this purely by you know, the kind of spreadsheet.
Right. Well, thank you very much for taking time out of your very busy diary for us. Where can we find out a little bit more about ConnectJets online?
Well, you can find us on www.connectjets.com. We're also on Twitter and obviously on Facebook. We have our offices here in Mayfair, and we're always with our doors open in 29 Farm Street. But yeah, we have a web presence, and obviously we have a team here that can answer calls at any time.
Gabriella, thank you very much.
That's all right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, great interview there, Peter. I think it's interesting of you know, trying to get across the advantages of a turboprop into you know, obviously it's impossibly pretty, as I would say, about the Avanti. The Evo is slightly upgraded. But you know, it's interesting. So biz jets are slightly in this kind of world of kind of fashion and sort of trends. So I know somebody who said that you know, once upon a time, thrust reversers were all the rage. You know, and everybody, all the biz jets had to have thrust reversers, and there was no benefit to it. People that did the engineers did the studies. They said, you know, why do you want a thrust reverser? And it went down to you know, the VVIPs who buy these jets, you know, and pull out the checkbooks and splash the cash. They liked having the thrust reversers because when they were used, everybody knew you'd arrived.
literally.
So I mean, you know, great looking aircraft and really sort of stunning. So it'd be interesting to see you know, what they can do in the UK market.
Well, as Gabriella said, you know, and when you look at the performance stats for it, it's got a bigger cabin than almost all of its comparable biz jets. It's not sloppy in terms of performance, and certainly an efficient one. But as you say, is it an egotistical buy in terms of getting a biz jet or leasing one of these things? Or is it pounds, shillings and pence? And I think the latter has certainly kicked in more recently. So we're really wishing Gabriella and the team there a lot of luck. I had a look at the aircraft at Farnborough, and I will say it's very, very different. I like it. I quite like it. But we shall see. Good luck to the team there. After the break, I get to talk to Darren Olivier, and Darren is the senior correspondent for African Defence Review, and he talked to us live from the African Aerospace and Defence Expo earlier on today, and tells us a little bit about what's going on that continent.
Yes, Tower American 182 Heavy is with you on the ILS for 34 right.
America 182 Tokyo Tower, runway 34 right. Good afternoon. Wing 02011.
02011, clear to land, runway 34 right, American 182.
Thank you. And after landing, expect vacate at the end of runway, Charlie 10, and a taxi via Kilo taxiway.
Okay, vacate runway at the end and taxi via Kilo, American 182.
Wing 02011.
02011, thank you.
American 182, turn left at the end of runway, Charlie 10, and a country taxi via Kilo, remain this frequency.
Hi, This is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian. And with me is
Max Flight. And we're both from the Airplane Geeks podcast.
And we're so crazy about UAVs that we've decided that we needed to start a whole new podcast. Yes, folks, you're going to get an extra half hour a week of Max and I.
Yeah, David and I have been hard at work producing this new podcast that focuses exclusively on unmanned aerial vehicles and systems. And as David mentions, it's a weekly show, 30 minutes in length. And we bring you news and opinions and industry experts.
And we've already talked about some very cool stuff. We've had a former Airplane Geeks guest, Jamie Dotson, on, as well as we have talked about UAVs staying aloft at 65,000 feet for 5 years. And we're trying to put a positive spin on UAVs. We're not trying to talk strictly about military uses, but the commercial uses as well.
So we invite you to take a look at the UAVdigest.com and give us a listen.
Or download us from iTunes. So we look forward to your feedback and hope you enjoy our new podcast. Again, that's the UAVdigest.com.
Senior correspondent for African Defence Review, Darren Olivier, joins me directly from the Africa Aerospace and Defence Expo at the Air Force Base in Waterkloof, South Africa. Darren, welcome to Extended.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. I know you're really busy at the moment. We're on day three of the expo, so thanks for taking the time out to talk to us. We're going to have a little chat about the region and also some of the things that have come out of the expo. But maybe let's just start by taking a look at the sector in sub-Saharan, in the sub-Saharan region of Africa. And let's start with South Africa. They're going through a defence review. What does this mean for their air assets? Because it's got several challenges at the moment. Obviously, the Gripen is well documented as an issue. What's this going to mean in terms of their air force?
Okay, well, the key thing to know here is that the SA Air Force has been underfunded terribly for years.
Yeah.
The budget has been kept very, very small, and it has generally grown at below inflation rates. The defence review is meant to be a whole new look at the approach taken, a whole new look at the kind of funding required, and it recommends virtually a doubling in the funding to the Defence Force by 2018.
Yeah.
At the same time, it also recommends a massive shift and change in the way the Defence Force is organised. You see, after 1994, there was an effort to integrate the former liberation groups into the SANDF, or actually what created the SANDF in the first place. It was the merger between the SADF and the various liberation armies. And as part of that, they brought in the services of private consultants, such as, I think it was at the time, Deloitte. And it really resulted in a very inefficient and not really combat-oriented structure.
Right.
So the Defence Review is a long, long overdue. In fact, it's been dragging on for years.
Yeah.
Approach at saying, listen, not only do we need to get the correct kind of funding, but we need to now get the correct kind of structure in place, the correct kind of units focus and whatnot. As part of that, obviously, it's the need to re-equip the Air Force in critical areas like airlift and maritime patrol.
Yeah.
The current airlift capability of the SA Air Force centers around 9 very, very, very old C-130s.
Yeah.
Yes, they were upgraded to what we call locally the C-130 DZ standard.
Right. What would we recognize that? Are they C-130Hs?
No, they're C-130Bs.
Bs. Gosh, they
so,
are old.
So they received a new glass cockpit.
Yeah.
And, you know, just various refurbishments. So effectively, they are still the same old 50-year-old airplanes.
Right, okay.
And as a result of underfunding, you know, very few of them are actually flying. I believe only 5 are currently airworthy, and of those, probably 3 are available at any given time.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the saddest sights that I saw at AAD, tucked away behind a hangar, was 3 of the C-130s completely stripped out.
Right.
So
they're not even airworthy, really, are they?
No. So right. That's the thing. So of the nine, at best, five can be used.
Yeah.
And of those, probably three at any given time. And that's really an issue only of funding. There's no other reason why not.
Yeah.
And aside from that, there are three CASA 212s in service. A CASA 235 was in service but was withdrawn. And that's finally a fleet of C-47 TPs, which are C-47s re-engined with PT-6 turboprop engines.
Wow. Okay. Gosh. And they are old as well, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. And then obviously at the bottom end, there's a fleet of Cessna 208 Caravans.
Yeah.
Right. So with South Africa having these extreme obligations to the rest of the continent, I mean, we've signed up to the African Standby Force, which means that we make up the majority of what's known as the SADC Brigade. Now, SADC is the regional grouping of Southern African nations.
Yeah.
At the same time, we're the first country to provide forces for the ACRC, which is African Capacity for Immediate Response to Crises.
Yeah.
So these require a lot of airlift.
And, yeah, that's right. And modern aircraft as well.
Exactly, yes.
You know, some of these older aircraft are going to struggle with conditions and the lift capabilities, aren't they?
Yes. And in fact, it came home to roost recently. I'm not sure if you heard about it, but South Africa was involved in fighting in the Central African Republic.
Yeah.
What we call the Battle of Bangui. And in the immediate aftermath, because it was a very, very light force, I mean, it was about 250 soldiers, lightly armed, against a force of probably between 2,000 to 3,000 rebels.
Right.
And they had no heavy vehicles. They had no armor, in fact, no armored vehicles whatsoever. So there was an attempt to swiftly fly up reinforcements in the aftermath.
Yeah.
And because South Africa has no heavy airlift of its own, the attempt was made to use private civilian contractors flying IL-76s and AN-124s.
Right.
But they proved so unreliable that most of the reinforcements only arrived 8 days later.
God.
Mm. So it's become an urgent crisis for South Africa.
Yeah.
And yet, at the same time, until the defense review is passed, at the moment it's currently sitting and waiting for Parliament to pick it up, and until the money's made available, there's nothing on the horizon.
Right. Understand. So what are the options moving forward? I mean, review aside, it obviously is identifying significant funding issues. What do you think are the options for the South African National Defence Force? Could they look at something like the C-17, possibly new C-130s?
Yeah, well, the C-17 is on offer. Boeing, once again, has a big presence here.
Yep.
Lockheed Martin obviously is punting the C-130J and C-130J-30.
Yeah.
In fact, they're very heavily punting the cheaper variant, the C-130XJ. And Airbus has been pushing the A400M for a long time. In fact, South Africa was one of the earliest purchasers of the A400M.
Right.
It acquired 8 back in 2009 or 8, I believe. And unfortunately, that was cancelled due to some issues around politics in South Africa.
Right, okay.
A really, really poor decision. But yes, my view is this. The A400M is currently best suited to the Air Force's needs.
Yeah.
The C-17 is fantastic. It's a wonderful aircraft. But it's also extremely expensive. And it cannot land on many of the smaller runways which we need to use.
Yeah.
For instance, there are limits on how often it can land on the runway at Goma, which is where many of our troops in the DRC are based. At the same time, the A400M offers aerial refueling as well, and that's something that the Air Force hasn't had since it's retired. It's 4 707s in 2007.
Right.
So, in terms of killing two birds with one stone, it gives us the ability to airlift all but our heaviest equipment. So, it can't carry our 40-ton tanks, but it can carry our Badger, IFVs, our Rattles, our Mambas, and all the rest. And it can carry, very, very importantly, actually, this is the prime consideration for the Air Force. It can carry the Air Force's Royal Falk attack helicopter and the RX transport helicopter without having to disassemble the entire rotor head.
Yeah, right.
Sorry, not the rotor head, the gearbox.
Yep.
And
understand.
The difference there is that if you dismantle that, it requires 24 hours and a clean room at the other end before the aircraft can fly again.
Yeah.
If you don't have to do that, it's just 4 hours.
Yeah, well, if you're flying into theatre, you're not going to have some of those resources open to you, are they? So
exactly, yes.
It's not realistic. What about fighter, the position of the fight, the status of the fighters then? Obviously, the Gripen issues have been long documented. Where do you think that will end up?
So that, again, is just an issue of funding. Unfortunately, it was kind of misreported. As to what was happening with the Gripens. The mainstream media reported that they were being, well, 12 of them were being mothballed. This isn't quite the case. What's happened is that the entire fleet has been placed into what's called a rotational maintenance phase. So effectively, the rule is every 60 days, each aircraft must fly at least once. Each aircraft has to fly a certain number of hours per month. And the idea is then to rotate the hours across the entire fleet.
Right, okay. All right, well, that makes more sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As opposed to merely having 12 aircraft just stored in a warehouse.
Yeah.
But, you know, that being said, the flying hour allocation for the Gripens is pitifully small. In a good year, they will fly about 600 hours.
Yeah.
Whereas they should be flying about 3,500 hours.
Right, okay.
And there's no way that's going to improve unless we see a major injection of funds.
Yeah. And of course, you've got all the pilot training issues, you've got experience, you've got weapons use, weapons practicing, incident practices. This is just, it's just not happening, isn't it? Is it? So the skills as well as the aircraft are falling into to misuse.
Exactly. You know, on Tuesday, I went to the biannual Air Force's air power capability demo, where they show off various aspects of SA Air Force air power. And, while they put on an excellent show, you know, you have to understand that they are doing the best they can under the conditions. So, you know, we were treated to Red Fox flying rockets, to cannon fire, to the Hawks and Gripens dropping Mach 81 and Mach 82 bombs.
Yeah,
and you know various showcases of what they can do, but there's clearly a lack of resources.
Yeah, okay.
And so what it means is that yes, the pilots may be sustaining the basics.
Yeah.
Basic air to ground, basic air to air. In fact, they still performed very well air to air at Exercise Lion Effort in 2008. Hmm. The SA Air Force's Gripens performed best in the close-in air to air role, although they were terrible in the beyond visual range aspect. So again, there you see certain skills are starting to atrophy. I mean, they haven't practiced air-to-air refueling in years. They have no experience, real experience with beyond visual range. And they don't have the capacity to do large-scale exercises anymore.
Yeah.
And this is true across the entire fleet. It's still quite okay in the fighter line because obviously to get there, you require a huge number of hours of flying time.
Yeah.
We're starting to see the issues lower down in the fleet, for example, in the caravans and light transport aircraft, where pilots are flying with arguably too little experience.
Hmm.
So, for example, I mean, we've had a few nasty accidents, which are not necessarily related to pilot error, but where pilot experience did play a role.
Okay. Well, before we look at some other countries and their air power, at Farnborough, Boeing, you mentioned earlier, and Paramount came together to collaborate on aerospace and other aircraft developments. Who are Paramount, and how are they going to complement each other?
Okay, so Paramount is a company that formed in South Africa in 1994. Originally, they focused entirely on the foreign markets, so really into Africa, and providing sort of turnkey solutions.
Yeah.
Using other companies' assets. But over the last 20 years, they started to build up their own internal capability to build and create products. They've done this not only through internal R&D, but through acquiring other companies that have those skills. So, for example, they acquired a company called ATE Aerospace. And ATE, you may know as a company that did the Superhind upgrade.
Yeah.
They have a fleet of UAVs. So that's given Paramount a whole new UAV division, and the ability to now carry on with its upgrades. And in fact, one of the big things they're doing is they're the only supplier outside of Russia who can supply the rotor blades for MI-8 and MI-24 choppers. So as they expanded, the biggest move they've made was to partner with a company called Aerosid. Now, Aerosid was also formed in the wake of the developments of the WaveFalk. So, for example, the chief the CEO of Aerosid was the chief engineer on that project.
Right.
And they have excellent skills in terms of building parts and new materials and whatnot. In fact, they provide parts for both Airbus and Boeing. On aircraft like the 737, the A320, the A350, and the A400M. So the idea was to take this skill in and this expertise in parts manufacture and combine it with R&D to create new type of aircraft, which is the Aerolac, which we'll get into in a few months, I presume.
Yeah.
And so this is how this has sort of come up from being very almost unknown to reaching a point where they're now probably the apart from the NEL, the dominant player in South Africa.
Right. Okay. So tell us what the Aerolac is.
Aerolac. Yes.
Yeah.
It stands for Advanced High Performance Light Reconnaissance Aircraft.
Right.
And light tech aircraft. Sorry. So the Aerolac is a quite unique design. It's completely clean sheet, and it was designed by a fairly young team. I mean, the average age of engineers on the team is about 35. And which is important for South Africa, where a lot of our engineering talent is aging.
Yeah.
And many obviously were working back during the 80s and 90s. Anyway, so the Aerolac is it's a high wing twin boom pusher prop design. The reason for this that they tell me is that it gives them excellent visibility through the front cockpit, which is shaped very much like the cockpit on an attack chopper. It's kind of stacked up with the pilots and the operator.
Yeah. Staggered. Yeah.
Yes, and it gives an excellent view up front and to the sides. It's quite light, not very big, but the idea is that this is done to fill the gap between where you'd normally use a UAV and where you'd go full on for a high-level attack chopper or a larger aircraft. It's designed from the start to be modular, so they've built this very neat system where the entire belly is a pod that can be removed within a few hours and replaced with 20 more cannons, flare turrets, extra fuel, extra Eglinton equipment, whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
And the idea being is that with the Air Forces needing to get more capability at a lower cost, you want to really fit as much into one platform as you can. And so that's the idea here. It performs very well, all the way up to 300 knots in speed.
Yeah.
And
okay.
It flies well. I spoke to the test pilots and they seem very happy with it.
Yeah. Okay, so where do you think the product placement will be? Obviously, South Africa is an obvious customer. Are they likely to buy it? Who else is likely to buy it?
South Africa doesn't currently have a requirement for it, although it would seem to make sense, especially with all the border patrol South Africa is doing. The initial target market was sort of the developing world, up into Africa, South America, countries that really, would perhaps have bought a Super Tucano, but that was too expensive.
Right.
And so the idea here is that you want to go, and again, that's the reason why the airframe is very simple. It's all steel, no composites, so it can be easily repaired in the field. The engine is a standard PT6, which is serviceable anywhere you go, and that was the original idea. But as they've gone on and on, they found a lot of interest, surprisingly, from countries that are a lot wealthier. It seems that they have a want or a need for a sort of light trainer and attack aircraft that can save money as opposed to operating your larger fighters. So at the moment, from what they're telling me, the market is extremely broad. They've got interest from all over the place.
Yeah,
In fact, that includes the US Air Force.
And of course, with Boeing now being a part of that, there's a more natural fit, and there's a lead-in supplier, US-based. So, of course,
exactly,
that makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense. Okay, Darren, we're running on, and there's still some things to cover. Let's come back to the Aerospace and Defence Expo then. Day three, I know you've already had two programs out on African Defence Review on the Expo. What have been the highlights of the event so far?
Well, one of the highlights was definitely the announcement by Danel of a new concept for a small regional airliner, which they're calling the SARA for South African Regional Airliner. It's a highway twin engine aircraft, turboprop aircraft, with a capacity of between 15 and 24 seats. And the idea there, from their own research, it seems, is that there are a huge number of routes that are developing in the country, which are serviced only, well, sorry, not in the country, in the continent, which are serviced only by buses at present. And there's really a need for a scheduled light aircraft to be able to service those areas, you know, very efficiently. And especially cross-border trade, you know, Africa has a lot of migrant workers.
Yeah.
And not all are extremely poor. You know, I mean, obviously Africa's growing at an astonishing rate.
Yeah.
And you're getting
massive growth, isn't there? Yes. Particularly in the feeder airline business.
Yes, exactly. So there is theoretically, there is this opening for a small little airliner. At the moment, it's very early in the process. You know, as I say, it's pre-development, not even development. They're still looking for interest, and they're hoping, I mean, even though Danel is state-owned and theoretically state-funded, they're looking to have this funded mostly by the private sector and by interest from airlines.
Yeah.
So you know, that's what was quite interesting there. Another highlight was Paramount bringing in the Arlac. The Arlac only had its first flight in August. So for it to appear at AAD is a very, very cool thing. And the aircraft looks I mean, gorgeous in the flesh. It looks a bit ungainly in photos, but once you see it in person, it really starts to make sense.
Right, okay. I'll have to take your word for that.
In terms of visiting aircraft, this has been a very quiet AAD. You know, I think with the defense review in sort of limbo at the moment, companies are very, very skeptical about flying the aircraft all the way down to the southern tip of Africa until they're sure that they'll have a chance for, you know, to acquire something. Sorry, not to acquire, to sell something. So yeah. The only foreign aircraft that I was able to see were a US Air Force C-17 and a C-130J, which are quite regular visitors. Aside from that, you know, it's been quite fairly quiet. The Arlac was announced beforehand, and yes, most of the activity has been in terms of ground and naval systems.
Right, okay. Well, Darren, we're running a little bit long here. There's still a lot to cover in the rest of sub-Saharan Africa. Maybe we can get you back on the show sometime to talk a little bit more about that. Can you just tell us a little bit about where we can find African Defence Review online?
Yes, no problem. The site is africandefence.net. That's defence with a C, because we spelled it correctly. And
okay, and you do have a quite an informative and very listenable podcast as well, don't you?
We do hope it is quite listenable.
Yeah, no, it's I found it quite intriguing. It's a part of the world I didn't know a great deal about, and listening to your programs has been really informative. So we'll put some links to that in the show notes as well.
Great, thank you.
Well, Darren, thank you very much for joining us. I know you're very busy at the moment, so good luck with the rest of the expo, and hopefully we can get you back on the show soon.
Definitely. Thank you so much.
Okay, really interesting interview there with Darren, who, as I said, popped out of the AAD Expo to talk to us. Some really interesting points. I didn't know a great deal about what was going on, particularly in the southern part of the continent, but C-47s with PT-6 engines and potentially upgrading to something as grand as the A400M. But can they afford it, Tim?
Well, this is a big question. I mean, as the report showed, you know, they've got a lot of the stuff that we talk about with the RAF's, you know, kind of budgetary problems. They've got exactly the same thing here, but at kind of smaller scale.
Yeah.
You know, grip in the sort of flying hours, limited flying hours for the pilots. You know, they're soldiering on with, you know, C-47s doing maritime patrol.
I mean, that's quite... does anyone know of C-47s flying anywhere else with PT-6 engines? I'd never heard of that.
It's a Basler conversion. It's I think the Colombia's got them and Thailand.
Right, okay.
But they... Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one. What's also interesting is about the Paramount Group's
Arlac.
But, you know, you think, look at that, and you look at something like the Scorpion jet, and you think, you know, are these kind of low cost coin stroke like strike, you know, are they actually the way forward for you know, many countries now?
Of course, Boeing have jumped in there, haven't they? And you can imagine that they could leverage that product in lots of markets, I would have thought.
Aircraft now, even something like the Gripen, which is, you know, the cheapest fourth, fifth generation fighter, you can buy. That is the cheapest one to buy, operate. They're having trouble sort of finding the funds for it. And they're talking about, you know, in order to rebalance things, they're going to have double the defense budget, which seems, you know, pretty, I don't know, unlikely, ambitious, optimistic.
Yeah, I think so too. But we'll stay in touch with Darren and the team at African Defence Review. They've got an interesting little programme, really useful to find out a bit more about what's going on in other parts of the continent. So we're going to get Darren back on the show. Okay, after the next break, we get to talk to Derek about flight simulation and to go through some of your questions and suggestions on flight sims.
Any ground land maintenance?
Lawn maintenance, I know you're there. I'll be with you momentarily.
No problem.
Okay, Glock, 30-0-2-0 heavy?
30-0-2-0, Kennedy. Taxi right, Bravo. Hold short of Victor.
The gate will be ready for departure 30 minutes from now.
Okay, then call me when you're ready to taxi.
Roger that. For information, we'll be requesting runway 31 left for departure.
Very good. Delay, expect delay for your route of flight off of that runway. It's not the selected runway for your route of flight.
Roger that, 30-0-2-0, because we're too heavy for runway 22. Ground 30-0-2-0, heavy.
30-0-2-0, Kennedy. Yes, I got that the first time. As I said, delay will be subject to conforming traffic. That is not the selected runway for your route of flight. Call me when you want a taxi.
Roger, with you.
Nice guy.
Aviation media has long been the domain of the newspapers and magazines.
Well, not anymore. I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran, and we're bringing aviation right into your radio.
Yes, we're making aviation cool and interesting for everyone.
Hang on, aviation's always been cool. Check this out.
How cool is this?
Grant, turn that down. Here at Plane Crazy Down Under, we've got pilots, engineers, air traffic controllers, industry leaders, even politicians dropping by to talk to us about the amazing world of aviation right here in Australia and occasionally in New Zealand as well.
Wow, that's cooler than I thought, mate.
Find us at planecrazydownunder.com, on iTunes, or lurking about on other people's podcasts just like this one.
We've got crazy accents and lots of great aviation content.
And we promise not to talk about the cricket.
No, never, not the cricket.
Quack, 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 quack.
What is cricket anyhow?
Something we win a lot. Oh, there we
go.
Okay, so this episode we have the great fortune to be joined by Derek Davis from PC Pilot Magazine. So one of the top, or the top magazine in concerned with computer flight simulation. So Derek, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for inviting me, Tim. Thanks.
What sparked your interest in aviation and specifically flight simulation in the first place?
That's a really good question, actually. I can't remember. I think, really, it was, I suppose with a lot of us, it was watching films like The Dam Busters, Battle of Britain, that kind of thing. But it didn't start to crystallise until I think I was around, I don't know, 12, 13, 14. And it kind of was spurred on from model aircraft. First model I ever was given was the old Airfix Mosquito in 1/72nd scale. And it kind of intermittently popped in and out of my kind of radar over years. But then I used to go, then it was actually, I think, like, my story is probably similar to other people where I'd go to air shows. And I remember one of the first air shows I went to, I saw the Vulcan when it was still, you know, flying. Well, actually, I didn't see it. I felt it. We were coming out of the underground. And you know, there was this, I'm not exaggerating, there was this kind of deep rumble, and it went right through you. And all it was doing was running up his engines. It wasn't even in the air. So from that, I think I'm still interested in model making. So my interest in aircraft and aviation hasn't kind of left me since my teens. In terms of flight simulation, that was a kind of an accident, because in a previous life, I was a graphic designer, and I used to work for one guy who was, this was quite a while ago, he was telling me about how he would stay up all night flying in real time across continents in a flight simulator in an airliner. And then I managed to get hold of something called Falcon, which was monotone. It was black and white, and it was on an Apple Mac, because most designers in those days, and still do, probably use Apple Macs. So, and it occupied the top quadrant of the screen. It was that small. But I loved it. I used to do my work, but stay after work and just fly this thing relentlessly. And then from that, I got into, I don't know how I fell into writing, but I started writing, you know, for free for one or two magazines, and I had my own column, and it kind of just went on from there. But really, my interest in flight simulation stems from a passion for aviation. If I wasn't into flight simulation, I'd still be passionate about aviation. So that's where it stems from, really.
Great stuff. You're obviously editor of PC Pilot. So tell us more about the magazine. What kind of articles are in there, and what sort of flight sims does it cover?
Okay. I've got the latest copy in front of me, which with the cover story, A New Beginning, which covers basically Dovetail Games. The basic aim of the magazine is to really evangelize about flight simulation, but at the same time, not to be exclusive. So the way it's split up is to actually accommodate all levels of experience and all levels of interests. So we'll have the reviews at the front of the magazine, but we'll have regular tutorials that cover those who have got hardly any experience with those who, what we call aficionados, that know how to fly the aircraft, know how to operate them, and just want inspiration. And really, if I had to kind of summarize what our aims are, it's really to educate, inform, and inspire those who read our magazine. So, for example, in the current issue, we've got reviews on DCS's F-15 Eagle, FlySim's 737-200 Twinjet. So we're trying to cover off not only FSX, but X-Plane as well. Airsoft's English Electric Lightning, Just Flight's DHC-1 Chipmunk, Alabo's R-66 Turbine. We're trying to introduce some helicopter in there. A2A Simulations' Piper Cherokee. And then when it comes to things like features, regular features we'll have to do with jet airliners. So really, the current series of tutorials for the airliners covers the PMDG 777. I have my section in there on air combat simulation, because that's kind of my, I've got a soft spot for anything that can basically fire bullets and fire missiles.
We all
I know.
So, Derek, if you're one of our listeners, sort of listening to this, and you like your air shows, you like your model aircraft, and you think, maybe it's time to get back into flight sims, or get into flight sims for the very first time, what would you start with, and how expensive would it be? I mean, some of these people have got kind of quite elaborate home cockpit, you know, front section of a 737 and things like that, hardware, throttles, HOTASes, you know. What's the kind of bare minimum to get going?
I suppose the initial advice to somebody just starting out, given what you've said, is really keep it simple and keep to your budget, but actually maximise, basically buy the most expensive computer you can afford, but stick to your budget. So if we're talking about the box itself, whatever your budget is, try and do some research on what's available. Think about, I suppose to begin with, actually backtracking, try and pin down what most interests you in aviation, because obviously if you're into flight sims, are you into airliners, GA, or into military? That will then determine, to a certain extent, what you buy in terms of hardware. if you're dealing with FSX or flight simulator, Microsoft Flight Simulator, for example, without getting into too much detail, flight simulator is what we call CPU-centric. So it basically relies on the CPU and the power of the CPU to move those frames across your screen. But if you're into something like DCS, the DCS World and everything that's produced by, within that brand, then that takes advantage of more modern day computers, 64-bit. So, you know, if you're into the A10 or into the P51D Mustang, or more recently now with the Focke-Wulf 190, F86 Sabre, MiG-21, which actually came out actually last week, then really that's what you've got to start off with. But in terms of cost, you can pick up a decent PC now for around £500, £600, really. And then think about the monitor. The monitor is as important, really, to a certain degree, because that's your visual virtual world. So, I mean, I don't go overboard, but I would probably say a minimum of 24-inch monitor. Graphics card, again, if you had to have a shopping list, the CPU, I'd go for either an i5 or an i7. The graphics card, you can either go for brands by ATI or NVIDIA. The jury's out on which one is better, so I think that's more of a subjective subject. In terms of joystick, I would personally, if you've got a limited budget, get something where you can actually have control not only over pitch and roll, but yaw as well. You can get some joysticks where you can twist the joystick. I don't get on with those, and which basically simulates the yaw moment, really. Those are the basics, really, that you should be thinking about.
Cool. What about multiplayer online? When we first, I remember back in the days, in first encountering, the idea that you'd be able to kind of fly online with other people would be just fantasy. But are there many people flying with each other on the internet? What can you do?
It's huge. It's huge. I mean, it's been huge for quite some years, really. It's got to the extent that you can either fly. I mean, you've got things like VATSIM, so that's for those who want to actually take it to the next level and be more serious about their flying. And that really caters for those who are more into the civil side of things, to do with 777s, 737s, whatever airline kind of grabs your interest, really. For the more combat-orientated individual, then... It's quite diverse, and really you've got to hunt around different, and it depends on the software you have. So I remember I used to be into, and still am to a certain extent, IL-2 Stanovic. So I used to go onto a particular server because I'd meet the same people on a Saturday evening. We'd speak to each other via TeamSpeak or whatever, and we'd actually emulate proper wingman to wingman procedures, really, and talk to each other. And you could actually talk to each other on individual channels so that you're, just as in real life during the Second World War and beyond, where without your opposition hearing what you're up to. So you could actually emulate certain engagements and cooperate with each other. So that I suppose what I would say at this point is, if you really want to experience flight simulation at its best, multiplayer is the way to go, because you haven't got a predictive AI or artificial intelligence, and you've got an unpredictable human being. So when you see that other aircraft coming your way, coming towards you at a closing speed, if you're in a Second World War plane, of say 600, 700 miles an hour, you know that that's a real person, and that adds another dimension and dynamic to the way you fly and the way you think.
Sort of like airborne chess, isn't it?
Yeah, but I wouldn't, and that's an interesting word you use there, chess, because dogfighting, I remember one guy, he was part of the, he was in the US Air Force, and I don't know if anyone remembers Falcon 3.
Yeah.
Pete Bonanni, he did a series of videos. And I've got, Art of the Kill. I've turned away from my microphone because I've still got the box here. And in there, he, you can probably, if you Google it on the, I don't know if you can still hear me, if you Google it on the internet and just type in Art of the Kill Pete Banani, he mentions this thing about, he actually says, dogfighting is not a chess game. It's a fluid, dynamic, forever changing, forever moving experience. Because in chess, there are, you know, if you make one move, you've got only a limited number of permutations to how you react to that. But in flight simulation, because you're dealing with three dimensions and with an unpredictable opposition as well, then it becomes, there's an element of chess in there, but there's also this kind of experience, and then you've got to weigh up your aircraft against his. So it's a visceral but also an intellectual thing going on there as well.
Okay, we've got time for one more question before we move on. This is fascinating stuff. So for my final question then is, if you won the lottery, and as well as obviously paying off the mortgage and everything else, what dream flight sim would you want made and why?
Oh, God. I've got to admit, if I'm honest, because I started in flight sims probably late 80s, and so I've seen the progression from then to now, I don't think we've ever had it so good. I mean, if you take it by time period, first of all, Rise of Flight, for me, you couldn't get better now, because that, for me, in terms of First World War, and I do read up on the history of that era, they really got it down to a T. Even the subtleties of when you turn on that Clerget engine of your Sopwith Camel, and it's ticking over, it's, you know, buzzing like a hornet. The wings rock due to the vibration of your engine.
Yeah.
If you look at it from the exterior. So attention to detail at the moment. So my dream flight sim, it's difficult, really.
Not EF-2000 with modern graphics?
No. I mean, I've got to admit, my call sign is Baron, and I tell you why. It's because one of my all-time favourites is Red Baron by Dynamics. Do you remember them? We're going back 1990, and that for me had all the ingredients of a flight sim stroke game. So really, I suppose, yeah, my dream sim, actually, you've kind of given me an idea, would be an update of Red Baron.
Ooh. Right, okay, so with that, on to I'll pass you back to, thanks so much for that, and pass you back to Peter for our next listener comment. So, we've got quite a few here.
Yeah, we asked several questions, Derek. The first one was, what was their favourite flight sim? And also any particular questions for you. So we've got a bit of a mixture. Okay. First one's from Neil Braden. He says his favourite right now is Microsoft FSX. Unfortunately, I've had to spend several hundred dollars on software add-ons to get it looking how I want it. PC sims have come a long way since the 80s when he first played solo flight on the C64. Says he couldn't envisage playing a flight sim on my phone. He also posted some graphics of that on our Facebook page if you're not old enough to know what that was. So that was Neil's. Joe Chung says he likes FSX as well, special add-ons. But he says, but for shooty-shooty games, he plays War Thunder. So I'm out on my depth with all of this stuff. So I don't know any of these. John Spielberger says he uses Flight Simulator 2004. Great scenery is terrific, although ATC is a bit lacking. He's also used X-Plane, less impressive scenery and simple ATC interaction. But the ability to build and test and fly your own aircraft was unique and put to good use indeed. That's an interesting point, isn't it? Is there anything that you can do that with now?
Yeah, X-Plane. X-Plane. Right, okay.
Right, okay. Next point's from Bob Dennis. He says his favourite's got to be Phoenix. Although he's a Mac user, he's tried two Mac comparable programs, but they were quote-unquote rubbish. Was then given an old PC laptop, which I just used for helicopter stuff. Is Flight Sim limited to PCs?
Again, X-Plane is multi-platform. You can even use it on Linux. So... But there aren't that many, I've got to admit. Ironically enough, the first flight sim I ever flew was on a Mac. Like I said, back in the day, that was felt. But I think, yeah, because of the market, more people have got PCs when it comes to gaming, and more people use PCs for gaming, whereas for Mac, people use Macs primarily for work-related things, really. So
the short answer is... showing off in Starbucks, you know. I'm working on my script, you know.
A couple more, and then we got some questions.
I'll try not to do that too often for you, Tim.
The Nin3R, he was a Flight Sim X with add-ons, and the Ghost Flyer Oz was Microsoft FSX with Orbix and FTX Aussie Scenery, if that means anything to anyone on this.
That's the thing with flight simulation. The host software, FSX or FS2004, that is your starting point. And then that's why it's been going for so long, is that a whole industry has been built around one product. That's why the third-party industry, that's why you've got companies like Just Flight, Flight One, A2A Simulations, because they've taken the ball and run with it. And so really you should think of FSX as your starting point, and then you can choose the aircraft and the products you want. And Orbix is a scenery package that has taken it to the next level.
Good friend of the show and display pilot Neil McCarthy, he says he's got too many to count. Now, this sort of goes away from PC flight sims, but next weekend I'm looking at a full-size 737 sim pit to add to his Spitfire sim and hopefully his F-16. Those who know Neil know he's not messing about. He's deadly serious.
So
that's an interesting one. We'd all like to be in Neil's boots, I think. Now, Mark is flying on Twitter. He said, what's your thoughts on Redbird's approach to PPL training, where you spend 5 to 10 hours in full motion sims before starting in a plane? That was an interesting question. I'm not quite sure how one can go about answering it, because...
I think I know what he's talking about here. I think Redbird is using A2A's Cessna 172 with a kind of a motion sim.
Right, okay.
Not entirely sure, but they had it kind of, you know, it's kind of like a little motion sim cabin, and that sort of combined with A2A's very, very detailed Cessna 172 as a sort of an abish initio trainer, really.
I do know several student pilots who have used Microsoft Flight Sim. In fact, when I was doing my flying training, when I couldn't fly, I was certainly circuit bashing in front of my PC. And of course, it isn't the same.
No.
But it certainly teaches you to look at your instruments, to get the setup, and to get the feel for it.
That's right.
So for me, it did help me.
Yeah.
It also helped me when I was looking at new airfields I hadn't visited. And again, not identical to what you see in real life, although given some of the scenery packages I've seen over the last week or so researching this, I'm not so sure about that. But it really did help me. So I would say, as a almost permanent student pilot, it's helped me.
Yeah, and I was going to say that, you know, I've spoken to various, over the years, to various flight schools, and the instructors that I've spoken to always say they can always tell if somebody has used a flight simulator on their PC for two reasons. One, some of them concentrate on looking on their instruments. They don't look out the window. But on the plus side, they know where everything is. They have a natural affiliation with the cockpit, and and so he can tell the difference between somebody who has and who hasn't actually flown a flight sim. If nothing else, it teaches you what each of the instruments do and what their function is. And it's the kind of the physical things that you can't, unless you've got a motion platform, that you can't translate into a desktop flight simulator. But apart from that, we even get letters from current airliner pilots that want to actually practice parts of in their training or whenever they do, you know, have to keep their proficiency. Yeah, their proficiency. That's the word. Yeah, exactly. They'll practice because that, particularly for instrumentation, because the level of sophistication and fidelity has got to such a point now. I keep bringing up PMDG, but also all the stuff that's been produced from A to A. I mean, recently, Justify brought out their Canberra, and to learn how to use that, I got hold of the facsimile, the Crashy Canberra pilot's notes, because you can go through the pilot's notes, and it's functional in there, everything. So look at the pilot's notes from Crashy, the facsimile whenever it first came out, and you can start the engine, control how the fuel flows, everything else. It was just really, if you have a go onto Justify's website, because they've got a few videos on there, or pick up, I think it was issue 92 of PC Pilot, where we had it on the, no, it was actually PC Pilot 91, we had the Canberra on the front cover, and there's a full review in there, and the fidelity is amazing.
Gareth, were you going to jump in there?
Yeah, I just wanted to add, just in reference to this sort of using simulators for training, there are a small number of guys flying Typhoon in the Royal Air Force who, as a result of an experiment, went to Coningsby, having been streamed to the Typhoon, and their first trip in the aircraft was their first solo. So they did the ground school and the simulator, and then went off and flew the aircraft on their own. Mm. So, you know, no dual trips, no instructor with them. First trip was their first solo. So the simulator played a huge part in that, obviously. Mm. As some people may remember, I was lucky enough a couple of years ago, last year, maybe, to fly the Typhoon simulator at Coningsby. Yep. And believe me, if I could have one of those at home, I'd be pretty happy.
I'm sure Neil McCarthy's working on it.
I had the fortune a few years ago to go to Lynham and go on one of their full motion simulators for the Hercules, you know, when it was still an ongoing base. And the pilots there, they had an instructor who was at the back of the, basically you go into a Hercules, the front, everything is as if you're in a Hercules cockpit, but at the back was a panel, and the instructor could tap in different parameters, and so you had two student pilots who were flying, I think they were flying from JFK, and because I was there basically as a journalist, I was at the back behind them, so they're going through their cockpit checks. And the instructor beckoned me to the control panel, and he basically told me he was going to actually insert a failure just before they took off. So they're ready to take off, and they taxied, and they're on their takeoff run, and it came in. And so basically he was trained, seeing to see how they reacted to that problem. And at the end of that session, it was in the evening, they turned around, and both of them were sweating. So it just goes to show.
Okay, one final question then from Joseph Vibrel, who's Cornelius CZ on Twitter. Before I tell you his favorite flight sim, I need to declare he's a virtual pilot. He displays with the BL Albatrossi, who are in their fifth year, and they are a virtual formation flying team. They fly L-39 Albatrosses. I think there's six of them. Wow. He also mentions the virtual Red Arrows, which, if no one's seen, are just awesome. I got the opportunity to spend some time with the virtual Red Arrows and do some work with them a year or two ago. Great, great group of people. But back to Joseph, and we'll put some links to his website and the BL Albatrossi site on our show notes. But he says, what is your perception as real pilots of us virtual ones? There's a challenge. That's a challenging question.
Hands up any real pilots in the room.
I declared my hand earlier.
I think the answer, my answer would be something similar to Derek's, in that I think what I've noticed in past few years is that, you know, it used to be if you said, oh, well, you know, you do flight sims, you know, obviously a few people will have give you an odd look. You know, you used to be there'd be a certain generation you know, airline pilots or military pilots who would instantly dismiss it out of hand. You know, it's nothing like the real thing. Go away back to your, go and do it for real. And now the fidelity is up to such a stage that there's this kind of crossover now, and you've got airline pilots that, that use laptops loaded up with FSX or whatever to practice tricky approaches. You know, some of them would do it. In, you know, some of them help out create some of the add-ons. Some of the military pilots help out creating add-ons for DCS. So it's a lot more. You know, it's all. I think also about a new generation of pilots growing up with computers in all parts of their lives. So the idea that you wouldn't interact with a computer or computers are untrustworthy is now, and aircraft have changed. You know, aircraft themselves have changed. You know, there's I can't remember how many million lines of code there is in an F-35, but it's 7 million, something like that. Mm-hmm. You've got to look at the flight decks of a 787 or an A350. Computers, computer screens. You know, people now. You know, a new generation has grown up, and I think that's brought the older, the professional pilot community and the enthusiast sort of consumer flight simulation together.
Yeah, I follow briefly with that. I suppose the greatest compliment that's been paid to desktop flight simulation was the fact that Lockheed Martin. You mentioned the F-35. Lockheed Martin bought the license of FSX and called, well, basically, it was the professional version of FSX, which was called ESP at the time. I remember asking one of the representatives from Microsoft, asking him, what does ESP stand for? He kind of told me basically it stands for extrasensory perception. And it was just somebody came up with it in a brainstorming session. So, but that's by the by. That is now basically prepared. Lockheed Martin's prepared. I'm not sure if everyone's au fait with that. Tim probably is. But they use it on a commercial basis. They don't use it for entertainment. So they use it as a simulation tool for various, bodies, military bodies, whatever, for creating simulators and particular simulators. If you go onto Prepared's website, you'll see they've already... got simulators for the C-130 and they've deployed those, but using something that was basically an entertainment product.
Okay, I need to wrap us up. I will tell you what Joseph's favourite is. It's Flaming Cliffs.
Yeah, that's by DCS.
Yeah, that's his favourite. I do have to ask Gareth before he goes, what was your favourite, Gareth? Did you have one?
I did. I thought long and hard about, because I've played on lots and lots and lots of them when I was growing up, and I have settled on Digital Integration's F-16 Combat Pilot as my favourite. It was quite a tough game, and it was kind of the first one I played that had a full sort of immersive campaign of battle in there, and I played that game endlessly, and when I was probably about 15 or something like that. I'm guessing mid to late 80s. I'd have to look it up, but that would be mine.
Mine was US Navy Fighters.
Yeah,
Yeah, that's right. Can't find it anywhere. It was never upgraded, I don't think. But there you go. Right, we must move on. After the break, we'll come back to Tim for the X-10, our top 10.
Hey, John, this is Sam Main.
Sam Main and Scannery.
Hi, good evening. We're here over building 87, requesting permission for repo back to Terminal A between November Charlie.
Roger. Line maintenance, where do you enter the ramp?
And maintenance, November Charlie.
Okay, there are other maintenance, that's why I used line. There's one of them, Tam. You just stand by. I'll be with you shortly. Line maintenance, where do you enter the ramp? Line maintenance, where do you enter the ramp?
November Charlie.
Line maintenance, behind that regional jet, proceed right on Bravo.
Right on Bravo, land maintenance.
10
maintenance, Kennedy
ground. 10 maintenance, Kennedy, I know you're there. I'll be with you shortly. You gotta wait your turn. You're the fourth one calling up there. You'll be the fourth one to move.
No problem, I'll stand by.
Shift change.
Back
at 2014. Oh, American 2014, you're on Alpha. All right. Are you able to make that left turn there, or no, you're stuck?
We got a little battery idea that.
Okay, let me see if I got a vehicle out there. Car 93 or car 97? Car 97, American made a wrong turn, a Tango Alpha and Alpha. Just wants to have a. If you can move the Valia maybe, or if it's just eyeball, see if you can make the left turn.
Ground control, family 081, did you get us moving?
Car 97, can Tim taxi out of the Tango Alpha? Thank you. Tim 8081 heavy, runway 22 right shortened. Follow American Eagle from the left.
Follow American Eagle from the left. Top 8081.
Okay, and it's time for our extended top 10. This episode of Extended, it's our top 10 flight sims. We look at some of the best flight simulations for the virtual pilot. Whether you're a frustrated deskbound maverick, like learning complex flight management systems, or they even help you get your real pilot's license, what are the flight sims you should have played? At number 10, Tornado. Hours of boredom followed by minutes of sheer terror is one description of war. The Digital Interactions Tornado Sim, released in 1993, replaced boredom with planning as you use the advanced mission plan to work out the best route through valleys and under power lines to strike targets at ultra-low level. When you did pull it off, seeing your four-ship strike package hit an airfield from different directions all within seconds was incredible. At number 9, Flight Unlimited. Little remembered today, 1995 Flight Unlimited is on this list because it's breakthrough technology in two areas. Photorealistic scenery, if your PC was beefy enough to run it, and advanced flight modelling that sought to replicate real-world aerodynamic forces. At number 8, Longbow 2. Another gem from the golden age of 1990s flight simulation was James Longbow 2, released in 1998, which put the player in charge of an AH-64D Apache Longbow helicopter gunship. A great lit mission-led campaign and the feeling of being a high-tech chopper. And even today, some virtual pilots still have this on their hard drive. Number 7, Battle of Britain 2, Wings of Victory. LLA con leader, Bandits at Angels 24, Target Manston. BOB 2 simply oozes period atmosphere of this crucial 1940 air battle. An updated re-release of an earlier sim for Rowan software. Battle of Britain 2 has been updated since by the modding community to the extent of individual skins for almost every fighter in the battle. It also features a highly immersive dynamic campaign, allowing you, the player, to fight the battle as the overall commander from either side. Number 6, Rise of Flight. A World War 1 flight sim. Rise of Flight puts you in the cockpit of those underpowered, flimsy wooden flying machines and then has people shoot at you. Fabulous flight modelling makes just flying about in those biplanes a sheer joy. And then there's amazing damage modelling where you can watch in terror as wings fold up and collapse. An absolute interactive history book. And number 5, Digital Combat Simulator. Tracing its roots back to Flanker in 1995, Eagle Dynamics Digital Combat Simulator, DCS, now has evolved into a military simulation masterpiece with paid Android modules such as KA-52, A-10C and UH-1 all joining the free version. It's so realistic that the A-10C module, with minor classified changes, is used to train real A-10 pilots. And number 4, X-Plane. Lift, drag, thrust and weight, X-Plane, now up to version 10, is the perfect flight sim for aeronautical engineers thanks to its blade element theory of flight models, which produces smooth and hyper-realistic sense of flight. The sim also has a vast choice of free and paid-for add-ons. And number 4, Falcon 4, stroke BMS. A huge war is going on and someone put you in charge of an F-16. Is Falcon 4 flight sim in a nutshell? Released in 1998, the height of the golden years of PC flight sims, Falcon not only simulated the flying of Viper, but also an entire air war. It was completely dynamic. Now updated with better graphics, more combat theatres via benchmark sims, no one has ever matched Falcon's hugely immersive campaign. At number 2, IL-2 Sturmovik. Released in 2001, this outstanding combat flight sim from Oleg Manox brought Sturmoviks, lags and Lakovings on the Eastern Front in World War II to a huge audience, opening people's eyes to these previously forgotten air battles. Expanded several times with official add-on packs, the sim is still going strong thanks to third-party mods. And at number one, it has to be Microsoft Flight Sim. First appearing in 1982, the regular world-spanning franchise spawned thousands of add-ons ranging from scenery to aircraft to airports, many of them free. Though Microsoft has now abandoned Flight Sims, FS has become the sim that would never die and is being reborn through Lockheed Martin's professional prepare 3D version and Dovetail Games' new reboot. And that's it. What's everybody else's favourite sim? I think we've covered them. Any choices that should have been on there?
I agree with the tornado one. I agree with most of them, actually. Cliffs of Dover, that's going to cause a lot of people to say, "What, you must be joking." Tim probably knows about it. I'll keep this brief, but there's two types of simulator back in the day. There was your study sims and there was your survey sims. A study sim was something like Falcon 4, which study in those days meant, one, it was devoted, the product was devoted to one aircraft only, and two, it was done to a high level of fidelity and replication. But what you have with Cliffs of Dover is you have a number of aircraft. So in theory, that would be a survey sim where you've got a group of aircraft in one package. But when you look at the individual aircraft, they are done to a study sim level of fidelity. I'll bring up another example where I did a series on Cliffs of Dover looking at each of the individual aircraft from the Spitfire all the way up to the Heinkel 111. And one of the drawbacks with Cliffs of Dover was the fact that they didn't actually have enough information in the documentation to tell you how to fly most of the aircraft. And so I did my own research and I managed to find some documentation that was done for RAF pilots to know how to fly certain German aircraft like the Heinkel 111, the Junkers 88 and the Ju-87 and the Messerschmitt 109. So I got hold of this stuff and they're on PDFs and you can buy them. So I downloaded them and printed them off. And using that documentation again, I managed to actually learn and how to get the most out of each of these products. Another aircraft within that simulation is the Blenheim. Again, there's no documentation within Cliffs of Dover showing you how to fly that and how to operate it, because I used to find that the engines would overheat too quickly. Reading the original Blenheim pilot's notes, it actually mentions that and tells you how to overcome that. So Cliffs of Dover, I know it started off really, has got a bad reputation, but a group of people called Team Fusion, they've taken it to the next level, and it's superb, really. So, and apart from the original Red Baron, that's another one I've put on that list.
Anybody else?
Only one other one that came to mind for me was Microsoft's Gunship, which was before the Longbow.
Yeah,
one.
It was.
It was a Sid. Was it Sid Meier?
That's
who
correct.
Was the name? Yeah. The guy. Yeah. Who? And I think there was an F-15 Strike Eagle one, which was very similar. And yeah. It's funny, actually, just while you guys have been talking, I've been Googling a few pictures of them, and they look terrible now. It's absolutely hysterical.
You could actually get some of these things to still run. I managed to pick up, do you remember F-117 Stealth Fighter?
Yes, absolutely.
That will run on a 64-bit system now.
Wow.
There's a website called GOG, which is Good Old Games. But I've got the original that I picked up from a charity shop in its original box, and I bought a USB floppy drive, because obviously it's floppy disk, installed it, and using DOSBox, which is a kind of sets up a parameter on your computer so that you've got a DOS environment.
Okay.
You can fly these things, and it's smooth silk.
I'm going to have to do that, I think.
The good thing about I remember about the F-19 Stealth Fighter, or that became F-117 Stealth Fighter, was there was different sort of it wasn't just kind of pile in there and drop bombs. There were missions, I remember, I seem to recall, where it was kind of Cold War, don't get caught, limited sort of operations, and then kind of full out or hell breaks loose, and you can it's basically weapons free. Really kind of kind of clever idea that you don't really get these days.
I would call it a thinking man's flight sim, F-117, because you can see some videos on YouTube of people that still fly it. And there was one video where This guy's flown it from, he's basically flown a whole mission from start to finish and back again. And you can see all the eventualities within that mission.
Okay then, guys, let's crack on. After the break, we'll get into our get involved and feedback section of the show.
Speedbird 176 Alpha.
Speedbird 176 Alpha.
Just be advised, we started the pushback and had to stop in a hurry because a catering truck disappeared behind the aircraft when he should have stopped. It was a Gates Gourmet big catering truck.
Roger, did you get a plate number?
Yeah, that's a bit dark for that.
All right.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
First, I'd like to thank Gene McCulker, who, of course, appears regularly in our space-focused episodes. He turned up at the US Apple store at the launch of the iPhone 6 and left all of the iPads, Macs and iPhones on the extended Talking Space and Astronomy Now web pages. So, fantastic bit of guerrilla marketing. We greatly appreciated being included in that list, Gene. Thank you very much. Over to emails. And we got an email from our Black Hawk pilot, who we featured on an episode a while ago, Brian, who also flew, of course, the VH-22. And, of course, he didn't have enough on his hands, so he's designing general aviation aircraft, which we talked about. A quick update, the design and the aerodynamic design and simulation testing have finally been completed. And now it's a proper flying wing. He's chosen the Delta Hawk 160 V4 turbo diesel to power it, and all of their flight performance and simulation studies have now been done. Interestingly enough, they've used open source freeware to do all of that. So, interesting point there. Construction of the first aircraft will begin in the US next year. And on a personal point, Brian hopes to potentially be back in a V 22 Osprey very soon, so we wish him all the very best. He signs off with keep up the great work on the program, we love hearing it. It helped make his recent 3-month deployment in Poland and the Baltics more bearable. He did add that the women there also made it okay too. I hope his wife, girlfriend or partner's not listening. Yeah. On to Hushkit, who sent out a note on Twitter trying to see which was the best aviation podcast. He listed us along with the Royal Aeronautical Society's lecture podcast in his list. So thank you very much for that. Of course, in the last episode, Tim's X10 top 10 was, of course, the 10 worst aircraft. It did create a little bit of a storm. David Vanderhoof said the list should be the top 10 worst military aircraft, not a single civvy in it. I didn't notice that actually on the night we recorded, but I suppose it was. We did then have some banter with David, but couldn't get out of him his worst aircraft. However, Pasadena Brian did wax lyrical on his worst aircraft. He said the worst looking is the Wright Flyer. If they were trying to get it to fly, why not copy a bird? Tell me what bird has a small wing in front and a large one at the back. Slightly controversial. But Brian also then went on, and in the fairness of a balanced program, I will read this out. He then says the worst aircraft I've been on is the DC-10. It's the worst commercial airliner. It was loud and it was ugly.
Breathe, Peter, breathe.
Yes, I know. This is sacrilege, sacrilege. He says the airliner did have some unusual issues from launch through to its retirement. As a side note, my parents were friends with Captain Denny Fitch, who helped get United Flight 232 back on the ground in Sioux City. Wow, that was an interesting story. Now, for those of you who may or may not know Pasadena Brian, he is an associate producer for the Airplane Geeks, but he's also, let's just say, very well travelled and is often interviewed on travel programmes about travelling, let's just say, closer to the pointy end than the blunt end of an aeroplane. And he said he did have his very best piece of Chateaubriand hand-carved in front of him on a DC-10. So I won't read out any more of his email because it's just not very nice to the good old DC-10. But he did have his best bit of beef on that aircraft. Let's move on. Pod's challenge in our last show was, of course, what was your aviation highlight of the year so far? Bods156 on Twitter said his aviation highlight was arrivals on Wednesday at Riyadh, the A7s and the S22s. Now, that was interesting. I think we were talking to you when the S22s were coming in, weren't we, Gareth?
They rudely interrupted our interview with a practice display, which, I will have to. I must remember to email the Polish air attaché to complain about that. Not.
Viv Porteous, she said that's a tough one, her aviation highlights, but top two have to be the Harrier and the two Lynx. Can't choose a favourite, but also Lynx the Draken in there as well. Anthony Lillis said so many to choose from this year, but of course the Lancasters and the Swedish Historic Flight were interestingly mentioned. Mehdi Azaray said he had five, the Vulcan, Super Connie at Farnborough, Red Arrows, the A400M and the Battle of Britain Memorial Flight. So thank you very much, everyone, for that. Now, normally at this time in the show, we give out a copy of the Dragons of Thin Air book by Doug Worrell. The book, of course, designed to help those one in four people afraid of flying. Now, we've given away 10 copies of this so far, and we've decided that the remaining few copies should go to flying schools and other related good causes for the book. So if you're interested and can send us a prepaid envelope, DM me or email us and we'll send one out to you. And we'll also give you a mention on the show. So thanks again, Doug, for kindly providing these books for you. And you can, of course, buy a copy through our Amazon link on the website. And over to Amy's pod challenge for this show.
Hi, Peter, Gareth and Tim and everybody listening to this episode of Extended. I have a new pods challenge for everybody this episode, and seeing as I'm on holiday in Wales, I figured what's more fitting than something MacLoop related. This episode, I'd like to know if you could go to the MacLoop and see any aircraft from any Air Force fly, which would it be and why? I think I'd choose the Dutch F-16s, and I think we all know why I'd choose it. I can't wait to hear the responses, and I'll see you all in the next episode. Bye, guys!
Okay, I think Amy's got us again there. I don't know. Anyone got any ideas? What aircraft and why would you like to see in the MacLoop? By the way, for those of you not in the UK, the MacLoop is a series of valleys in Wales, and they're notable for their use by military aircraft for low-level flying and some fabulous photography. So, any suggestions? Has she got us stumped?
TSR-2.
I was thinking of that. That's what I was thinking of.
In wraparound 80s camouflage. Yeah, I'd love to see that.
For me, it would be, because I've got a soft spot for First World War aircraft. There's a company, Tim, you probably, well, actually, all of you might know, TVAL, the New Zealand company, that's basically, think it's been underwritten by Peter Jackson of Lord of the Rings fame. For me, it would probably be the FE-2B.
You'd have plenty of time to get a good shot.
Yeah, you would, wouldn't
it? Low-level dogfight around the Welsh...
There's enough. That's a good idea.
How about you, Gareth?
We see that, with all due respect, you know, you've kind of all got it wrong. I appreciate the sentiment that it's got to be something that's not flying anymore, I think, but it's got to be something huge and impressive. So for me, it's going to be a Convair B-58 Hustler, I think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Presumably on some sort of deployment to Lake and Heath for an exercise with Tim's TSR2s or something like that.
Right, well, there are suggestions. If you'd like to make a suggestion, contact us on Twitter or on our Facebook page or email us at Aviation Extended. Okay, over to promoting aerospace then. I had one on the list, and it's actually one for you, Tim. It's the Careers and Education event at the Royal Aeronautical Society for 11 to 14-year-olds, which is on the 7th of October.
Yeah, that's right. It's part of our outreach for spreading the word, you know, spreading the sort of the magic of aerospace and science and maths, and it's a free space event in London. So 11 to 14-year-olds, 7th of October. Details are on our website, aerosociety.com. We want as many young people there as possible.
We'll put a link to that in our show notes, of course. Gareth, how about you?
I'm just going to give another plug, because it's an opportunity to do so, for the Canadian Warplane Heritage Museum, I think. This incredible adventure with their Lancaster. And what we didn't mention earlier is that they, you know, had an engine go bang sort of halfway through this. And, you know, incredible sort of resilience and ingenuity and, you know, sharing of parts and expertise to get the aircraft up and not missing too many shows. But there's, you know, I've seen a few of the figures being bandied around for what that's going to cost them. So I know they're going to appreciate masses of support, and hopefully they get it on the back of the tour.
Okay, Derek, how about you?
For me, I want to promote the Flight Sim Show 2014. We had the first show at the RAF Museum at Cosford last year, and we were just really surprised by the enthusiasm and the success, really. And it was Tim would back me up on that. It was heaving with people. It was so this time we're going to have it on the 4th of October between 10 and 5 p.m. Everyone's welcome. More details are in the current issue of PC Pilot on page 10. So, or if you want to find out more, go onto the website at www.flightsimulatorshow.com.
Yeah, it was great last year. Really good. Get there early, folks.
Yeah.
Tim, do you have anything else that you want to mention?
Just that space event, really. If you've got any AV geeks, with the famous Royal Aeronautical Society pub quiz is back. So that's happening on 1st of December, London. If you've got any, want to start getting a team together, want to start swatting up on obscure aviation facts, now's the time. So 1st of December, be there or be square.
We do have to get an extended team, really, don't we?
We should do, really.
We really are a poor excuse for a team we've not entered. Okay, well, let's see how we get on with that. Also, shout out, of course, for our own Aerospace X Awards. Don't forget, you need to get those nominations in by November the 1st. Six categories: best aerospace watch, best product helping the aviation industry, best airport, best online resource, best restoration project, and of course our very own extended best aerospace product. You can make a nomination by emailing us x10d@mail.com and send us your details and the reason for your nomination. Jonathan Duke, of course, a very good friend of the show, has already tried to get in to nominate another Braymont product. Of course, the Braymont 2 was the winner last year of the Best Aerospace Watch. This year, he's nominating the ALT-1C. He says it's functional, beautiful, and elegant, and in his opinion, the definitive aviator's watch. Unfortunately, most of us would have to take a mortgage out, so we'll have to watch that space and keep those lottery tickets rolling in. So thanks very much for that, Jonathan. But that's the sort of thing we want to hear about. We want to hear about your nominations. You can self-nominate. If you've got a company, a project, a business that you want to nominate, please do. But remember, November the 1st is the closing date. Okay, we would like to thank White Arts, Live ATC and Peter Dixon for their contributions, and of course to Doug Worrell and Basic Six for supporting Extended. Big thank you to Amy Parkin for another Pods Challenge, which almost caught us out. Now, we use Twitter and Facebook as our main engagement tools in between episodes, so if you don't follow us, then you get to miss out on all of our activities during the month. So look us up at Aviation Extended, that's all one word, and no leading E on Extended. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. Okay, where can we find you guys online? Let's start off with Tim.
Okay, I'm on Twitter at RESTimR. You find the society at www.aerosociety.com.
Okay, and Gareth?
Yeah, it's Gareth_Stringer on Twitter for me, and www.globalaviationresource for everything GAR-related.
And Derek, thank you very much for joining us today. Awesome. Where can we find you online?
Basically, PC Pilot, www.pcpilot.net. Or on Facebook, just type in PC Pilot and you'll find us on Facebook.
Right. Thank you very much for joining us. It's been really interesting.
Yeah, fantastic.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Derek.
Cheers.
You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter and at xtpmedia.co.uk, as well as facebook.com/xtpmedia. I'd also just like to say before we go, a big thank you to all our new listeners. We have recently picked up a lot of new people who have come to listen to the show. We hope you've enjoyed this show, like the others. Please do leave us feedback. About 80% of our listeners listen through iTunes, but we very rarely get feedback from you. So we do all of this for you. Please leave us some feedback on iTunes. And with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Gareth Stringer.
See you next time.
And it's goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Goodbye, everybody. See you next time.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember to stay tuned into this frequency, Extended, Europe's premier aerospace radio station.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme. Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
All right, well, I've just added the wrong person then.
Hello, it's Skydiver. Get him on.
Right, let's do that again then, shall we? And Darren was calling us directly from the African Aerospace and wasn't going to do it, was I? Let's do that again.
First one of the night.
Ugh. I'll send you a text if you're running over time. Yeah, that might be the best way of doing it. Yeah, that's right.
Just cough.
Quite heavily, so...
Are you saying I'm likely to waffle on? That's a wrap.
Well done.
Thank you.
Extend it.